Dennis McKenna's book, The Brotherhood of the
Traveling Pants.
The Brotherhood of the Something Abyss. The Cosmic. It's not Cosmic. But Terrence McKenna, you know, so that's writing a story about all their lives. He's just like, I can't believe he just got into all this, like, data about their grandfathers and mothers. And it's like,
his parents? Yeah. His grandparents? His?
Yeah, it's like,
you would care why?
Yeah, it's like, why is he going on about this? I want to hear about their exploits or their revelations or what have you. I don't know if you know the character. It was a sort of a psychomot, I guess you would call it. You know, it was very one of those guys that one of them, like the guy that was really got into mushrooms and psychedelics and then into the sort of shamanic experience from the shamans.
I think I
probably heard it in the context.
I heard that recently too, intrepid psychonaut. I thought
that's really
nice. I like that.
It's hard to explain, like, to other people that have the resources and you want to travel the world, like, yeah, the world doesn't need to be because the outside world is different than anything. Like, it didn't know that.
Yeah.
The inside world is a really fascinating. You can go outside on this. No, shit. I guess the inside.
Right.
So I think that's what seems to be
on the path. I was out as a teenager, and my mother thought I had a problem. Why? All my other friends are out doing stuff. What's the matter? What are you doing here? I said, there's a rich inner world.
There's what? A
rich inner world. No, I was in my teens. But I went to plenty of parties. Plenty of this and that, but there were times where I was out. With Big Floyd. Do I wish you were here? You know, and just contemplating chords. Before I knew what chords were. How that was going.
If you have tendencies to travel, it's really hard to relate to the world. It's totally different.
I love that cheese.
I am.
It's a suffering belief. And then there's a part of me that thinks that I'm missing. Give up all the different world stuff. Just go to the effort. I know.
Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah.
But it's funny.
If you make something out of it, if you don't make anything out of it, I'm not going to disappoint you because you haven't made anything.
Oh, yeah, and before I was, I had my journal, I was reading that Stan Hunter's thing, so maybe that has something to do with it. Is that his name, Stan Hunter? Oh, who's cool.
Oh,
I think that's what he said, or... Did you guys read that?
It's
Peter Brown's...
Stan's personal story.
I just got bored.
Are you talking about the book?
Oh, hon.
It was short, though.
Are you
I know,
about
but I still
his book?
Yeah, his book.
Yeah, I have that one on Kindle, too. So I was going to do
A few words about me first.
Yeah. It's like, what? This isn't the place.
Neither time nor the place.
I didn't mind it, but, you know, I can't stay away from those stores. So.
Has Stan had enlightenment experiences in his book?
Well, he just mentioned what was it. He had gone to a Buddhist retreat, and then he couldn't sleep for like 2 weeks, and he took a sleeping pill or something. That was it. Like, and then he started moving the finger or something like that.
It's like an everyday.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't. Do you remember? I can't even
remember. Oh, I didn't get as far as that.
Oh, okay.
See, I quit like paragraph two.
I can't remember now. That's all I remember is you started. Yeah.
I'm just so bored by personal stories anymore. Yeah. I can't.
Well, I thought it went quite quickly. It wasn't too elaborate.
It wasn't overly indulgent.
I didn't think so.
No.
That's too far removed.
Yeah, maybe too far removed.
And this is the yeah. the very influential person that sort of mentored Peter. Is that right? Is that who we're talking about?
No, you're talking about Stan, who's a student of Peter's, memorializing Skype phone call sessions and emails with Peter.
Oh.
Working through, you could say, Stan's, you know, personal adventure.
Oh, okay.
All right? So it's insight into an intimate mentoring relationship with self-realization as the so-called prize.
That sounds really cool.
He got to do it. What's really interesting is he got credit for, I forget his name, a master's or a PhD program, something. He got credit from his university for doing it.
Well, then.
So he's worked in an angle of and get credit for it. I vote for that.
Yeah. Sounds like a strategy to me.
Yeah. It's a strategy.
You have to do something with your sabbatical to prove that you've contributed, right, to your field of endeavor. So if you can turn your guru conversations into notes on your sabbatical and get credit for it, why not? Yeah. Well, you know, it's very, it's good. I mean, it's, you know, bold and fearless of Stan to take the initiative to interface with Peter so frequently, so intimately, to really work through, you know, his journey that way. Not very few people take advantage of, you know, Peter's availability to do just that. So you do get a unique peek into, you know, the tennis match. Of my mind is saying such and such, and the sage, right, replying to it. That's cool. I haven't read a word.
Well, the only thing is in the beginning, it's just a string of, like, things.
Yeah, staccato.
Yeah, so that's not, you know, necessarily all that readable. It's just, like, reading quotes or, you know, but
mm-hmm.
I was hoping there'd be a little more, you know.
When you're trying to stay true to just what Peter said, that he recorded and actually just really stay true to what came out of Peter's mouth, I could see the merit in that.
Yeah.
Instead of filtering it through, oh, this is what I think he said, this is how I think. So maybe he was trying to keep it.
Yeah.
Documenting all this.
Well, when we sent it out to the Open Doorway email list, Stan was greeted by a swarm of, you know, 20 or 30 people that were absolutely ecstatic with the existence of this work and very grateful to Stan for, you know, putting it together. So, for now, he is the celebrity of the hour to beat.
Tell them your dreams.
Yeah, you see, it's like, you know, if the attention starts going over there, you know, you have to fight back.
Bring that to the East Coast. Go.
Yeah, really. We have a lot of fun, you know, yabbering with each other during those retreats and emails and stuff.
He's so funny because he comes out in the morning sometimes and it's just like he's got this little, and he's just got
kind of like Woody Woodpecker.
Okay, Stan or Peter?
Stan.
You
just
want to
see him. He's just adorable.
Yeah, yeah.
Sweet guy.
Yeah. He's irresistible.
How can you not do sidetracked on the adorable of the story. Now, Catherine very clearly states, I'm not interested in personal stories again. It's kind of all we really managed to touch on so far at this point.
That's right.
Get closer to something that's not that.
Yeah, well, you don't need to, right, really get past it. It's the, you could say it's the delusional element that's worth looking into. We're not going to stop this from proliferating, right? That's like, you know, the finger in the dike thing and it starts leaking, right, all over the place. So that's not going to happen. The degree to which one is identified with this wonder field makes it appear as if, you know, we're living as a creature, as the product or in companionship with our personal story and memory, justifying, if you will, pure chaos to make it appear useful to me. And that's fine. Except when you find yourself nudged in one or a million ways to get more out of it, right? To get deeper, more authentic, to fulfill something that you're not even quite sure what it is that you're hoping and wishing to fulfill, right? If you're not inoculated with some form or forms of suspicion about this impersonal beatitude, then you'll remain as a person in a life, negotiating and navigating what you can according to your nature, good, bad, or indifferent, criminally insane, or kind of a count-on gal or guy. Doesn't matter. Yeah, and old age, sickness, and death will catch up with you, and then, you know, there'll be a headstone, or there won't. There's not too many headstones in Saddam Hussein's Iraq when bodies were just, you know, bulldozed into giant pits. Or how many births and deaths there are in a day, right? I don't know what the numbers are lately, but there's more births than deaths. But the deaths are staggering in terms of the number of, you know, humans that perish in a day. And you have to say, most of them do not leave a headstone or accomplishments or success behind. The very challenging part is that if once we're inoculated with suspicion, which is a good thing, painful but good.
Suspicion that there's something beyond just...
Yes. Right. You're no longer sanguine with the plateau that you've reached as a biologic psychiatric character on Earth. So that hurts, but it's good. It's in your best interest. Now, because we're so indoctrinated into the human frames of reference, when we want something to change or we want something to be better, we want it to be better or change through the filter of the human impressionism. So a better car, a better partner, a better parking space, a hairdresser that will finally do what I ask her to do.
That's what I want.
Yeah. You know. I mean, the perfect coffee maker. With, you know, at 5:30 a.m. it grinds the beans, it drops them in, you know, beautiful, pristine water pours through. At 6:30, your Zen alarm goes off, you read a little Nietzsche, you head off into the kitchen, and you got a hot cup of fucking Joe. I mean, you know, okay, I'm down with it. And in the West, right, we do surround ourselves with a profound amount of gadgetry, right, helpmates, efficiency devices, pleasuring devices. The refrigerator. Jesus Christ. What percent of
primates living today on this abundant earth can go to a refrigerator. Yeah. Yeah, not that many. Really. But for us, it's like, oh, what do I feel like now? And if I can't get it from the pantry or the fridge, I'll hop in the vehicle, burn some dinosaur farts, and get it someplace else. And still, despite this untoward abundance, we're racked with dissatisfaction. So we try to up the satisfaction equation on the interpersonal level, on the relationship level, on the creature comfort level, whether that's prurient or otherwise. Or we want more stuff, or to go to the moon, or, you know. So we're racked with, you could say, the fulfillment of desire as a jail sentence.
Because it never, ever gives you what you want.
No.
It's never satisfied.
No. But you've seen, you know, the brilliant light on the faces of people without that stumble into just a little pinch of with. And, you know, it's heartrending. There was a short video we saw of a lovely young teenage boy in Africa, born deaf. Did the chores, took care of the animals, was, you know, dutiful and kind in his family unit, but you could see the oppressive depression and loneliness in his face. And the miracle of this brief video is that someone had gone to a university to learn signing and how to teach signing. So you saw a film of the teacher setting up pictograms at the front of the room and bring in deaf people from miles and miles around that had never had language organized that well. I'm sure they figured out some right kind of way to communicate. And he, this young man, was one of those people that came. And as the instructor at the front of the room was showing them the alphabet and the pictures and pointing out that with your hands you could create a means of speaking, his whole demeanor, this young boy's whole demeanor, shifted so profoundly into pretty much unutterable, excruciating joy. Because the first time in his adult life, he was given the tool of language. And his whole universe changed so profoundly, like going through a gearbox of enlightenment. So on Earth, with 7 point something billion of whatever these are, right, you have a bandwidth of despair and elation, which is immeasurable. And where do we live? Well, we kind of live within a very narrow corridor of our so-called personally constructed, imagined tunnel vision of a life. And we're okay with that until we're not. And if we're not okay with it, where do we turn? Well, Thich Nhat Hanh's almost dead, so, you know, you can't get darshan from him, right? You might turn to Stan or Peter, you know, or the Eagles. That's a cover. It's a little too fast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a Spanish version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now it's very tricky. See, once that suspicion sets in, you know, you might go Hindu, you might go Buddhist, you might follow Amici around or the Grateful Dead, you might listen to Terence McKenna or inject or smoke or drink ayahuasca or DMT or whatever, just so you can get your fix for transcendence satisfied. Or you might become a yoga teacher, do headstands and camel pose, or a chant artist, and sing Hare Krishna until the cows come home. You know? And you might be very successful. You might make a lot of money and have, like, groupies and people that are then interested in having affairs with you.
Is that what it's going to take?
Yeah. Yeah, really. I got to go. Got to start practicing my Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Has the phone ringing yet? For a date. Yeah. Then it gets worse. You might actually listen to enlightened people interviewed on Buddha at the gas pump. Now you're really fucked. Because you're in the midst of a really grandiose, narcissistic, right, entertaining infomercial of absolute heresy and bullshit. And then you get lit up and you think, well, that dude or dudette seems enviably enlightened, whether it's money or spiritual experiences or a cute partner. Maybe they're published. They travel the world giving non-dual workshops. You know, they issue a monthly newsletter. You're like, man, I could roll with that. And then you're screwed because you have your own crappy life and your own crappy employment and your crappy family and everything's crappy. And you just can't seem to fit enlightenment into your crappiness. You know? And you're like, oh man, this really sucks.
And you might, you can't afford it.
Yeah, you can't afford to be enlightened, you know?
Money.
Yeah, I mean, Wayne Dyer is worth how much?
Go to the Wolf of Wall Street.
Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah, then you're really screwed. Because you think that, you know, you have to go down to the Nogales bus station and learn Spanish so you can get your hands on Carlos Castaneda, right?
When they take your place away, aren't
you? And all the while this is going on, this festival of oneself, right? You get a carrot here and there. You get a moment's peace or a good dream or an insight or a bunny bounces out of the woods and sits by your feet for a few minutes just to let you know, hey, you're on the right path, you know? You get a wink from a wild creature, you know? You go to a preserve and a lion pisses on you and you think, I'm on my way. Yeah, or you've been at the 12-step meeting now for, you know, 4 years or 5 years and you've done a bunch of service and you're starting to realize what an insufferable, selfish asshole you've been for your entire life, and it's just starting to break through your shadow that, wow, it might even be possible to live life in a more, right, joyful manner with service to others. You're just starting to get that. You're like, wow. And that's great, too. You know, then you become the treasurer of the meeting, and you make sure to get there early and set up the coffee, and, you know, you're starting to sponsor people, and you're in your recovery group.
Do you want me to take that for you?
Paul Hederman comes to town and you're like, whoa, I had no idea that I could travel lighter. You see how it rolls, you know? It's just weirdness rolling through the meadow of you, really, right? The meadow of you.
We've
the life you call you.
That, so.
Yeah. Yeah. So then you become either more refined or perhaps more greedy, more impatient. Right? Maybe angry. And that's good. Yeah? Now you're getting pissed off. Because those carrots aren't enough. And you find yourself returning over and over again to the tunnel vision of yourself. And you're just done with yourself. Really. You start getting really fed up with yourself. Forget about other people's stories. They went out the window a long time ago. Now, you're like fed up with yourself. With the shit that flows through your head. With the way that you justify your life. With your to-do list. With your obligations and your regrets. And all the ways that you feel justified in being retributional to people and institutions that have harmed you. So you can become overwhelmed with getting everyone back for, you know.
Count of Monte Cristo style.
Yeah. Big. Do it big. Right. And while that's going on, while your despair is unfolding, still these horrible yogis on the internet and in the news are raking in huge amounts of money, counseling others more successfully than you, both as a devotee or as a, you know, purveyor, right? And you're just really pissed off because someone comes along and reads Byron Katie and their life just turned around in a big way and it's starting to work for them and they're doing JYNs and they're getting certified and you can see them just going up and up and up and up and up on the graph of their stupidity. And you're like, why didn't that happen to me? Why did I only get 10 minutes out of it? 10 minutes worth of joy for the $30,000 I spent. And this motherfucker is really rolling in this shit, and they just started. And you try to compare yourself to Ramana Maharshi's devotees or the people that hung out with, you know, near Sagadatta or Ramakrishna, and you're like, can I find anybody like that? What about me? It gets really bad. It gets really bad. Oh no, it would be worse if I went that way. So sooner or later, in the midst of this cacophony of, you know, self-indulgent misery, self-importance, the presumption of knowledge and accuracy, right? The presumption that you know what reality is, that you can measure it, that you can say something about it, that you can commit to it, that you can be loyal to it, that you can transcend it, right? All of this hubris has to go. And it's not easy. Because, right, we're conditioned from a very early stage, pre-Cambrian maybe, whatever, pre-Umbrian, whatever, from a really early place, we're conditioned to, right, you could say hardwired, even though that's not quite accurate, to make sense of this, to place ourselves in a context in the midst of the present proliferation of the whim of the Divine Mother. We're compelled to eke out a place for ourselves in the midst of an unspeakable beatitude. And so we create hypothetical resonances, right? Insistences, demands, stories, justifications, aspirations, vows. And all of this nonsense, absolute nonsense, is what is the medium and the structure and the content of what you call I, me, mine, life. Now, reality. What I want, what I deserve, what I need, what I'm after. Why not me? The myth is profound. We have to creep up on this around the back. You have to be able to see, be willing to see that what's appearing in your consciousness right now is unbelievable. This is an excruciating ecstasy right now. And even if you let the possibility of that in just a little bit, it helps you to see how you or your consciousness or your experience turns everything into a trivial photonic packet that I can ignore so that I can remain focused on my needs, wants, issues, and to-do lists. Right? You see how profoundly you live in a tunnel vision that is absolutely dissatisfying and malnourished. And if the aperture starts to open just a little bit, then all of this glory starts pouring in. But glory has no utility. And that's why we blot it out. Because we insist and demand upon utility. And once we insist and demand upon utility, then this ceases to be glory. It turns into nuisance. An obstacle. And get out of my way. See, because you have a place to go. You have a life to fulfill. A person to be or a person to meet. And so beauty is in your way. Because you want to get your fair share before you die. And so you blot out the beauty of it all. It's like you jump in your coffin and you put the lid down on yourself. I'm good. I think I'll just live in this coffin.
Oh my God, that's so
good. You spent good money for it, you know?
And it's a well articulated and beautifully crafted coffin. It's got your fucking family crest on it. And wheels. You can drive it.
It sounds like that story about the master and his emissary. I won't be able to articulate as well, but I thought maybe somebody else could.
A musical note touches you a certain way if you give it a little bit of attention. What's aware of the music, the eminence of the music, the joy of the music, is not two. It's a non-dual singularity of transcendence. And you can hear and feel music that way. Because you're not processing it, right? Through story, through utility. The hearing is the liberation. The hearing is transcendent of self. So you show me anything in this atmosphere that's not exactly the same. Find one thing in this present atmosphere that's appearing in or to or touching any of your sense plenums, including the miracle of thought and association, that's not transcendent of self. Find one thing. I dare you. You see, the entirety of your experience is transcendent, is not to. Not processable. This is the miracle you've been holding out for. This one. Hello. Miracles are us. And this is no Course in Miracles. This book is thinner than a napkin. So you can notice the habit appearing in your experience of processing things through the discursive mind, right? Through the yay and the nay. through the attraction and the aversion, and most of which is just summarily ignored. Right? Most of your experience is considered neutral and therefore absolutely ignored. We just pick up a little bit on the thrill elements, right? The peaks of attraction and aversion. And so we live excruciatingly narrowly. And we imagine that what's appearing in mind, were there one, as thought, were there any, tells the truth. You listen to your internal dialogue, subtle or express, as if it's telling you and can tell you the truth. And it can't, ever. That's a shock. Because we're so dependent on how we feel about a thing, what we're thinking about a thing, what we or others are saying about a thing, for it to be told to us, demonstrated to us, is true. We're not relying on chaos, irrationality, beauty, transcendence, excruciating bliss to be true. No, we're relying on secondhand referential pointers to be true, as if language can tell you the truth. And it can't. So this guy in the Costco, I'm in the Costco, this guy calls me up. He lives in California, and he's in one of his, you know, excruciating mind moods, which he does very well. I mean, you know, the judges say 10, 10, 10, like, you know, Dancing with the Stars. He's that good at it. But if it's painful, you know, we know this, right? When your mind has convinced you of something which makes you small, you are not happy. You're pained, you're strained, you're really under the influence of a grandiose hallucination. So I'm rumbling through Costco, you know, trying to get more than my fair share of samples.
Out of my way.
Like, I'll put my hat on this way and then turn it, or I'll change my jacket and go back for another piece of fudge to make it look like, oh, that's my first one. I'm deplorable. So here comes this call, and I'm like, I'm a guy who pretends to change his appearance to get another sample at Costco. Why would anyone ask me anything? You know? I should be out back packing Brussels sprouts. I think I will, as a matter of fact. Sounds good. So here comes this call, and someone who I know, you know, that has spoken with me in this way before, is unloading a tsunami of regret and fear and failure and absolute ruination. And I light up. I just light right up. I'm like, oh, it doesn't get better than this. You know?
You can take this, Carly.
Someone wants to take things home?
You want some?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll take it. You see, when we're complaining, as we ordinarily do throughout the day, about minor things, you're not going to get a lot of mileage out of that, right? Because you, as the complainer that we're all so good at being, it's like, yeah, what else, isn't it? But if you're really, really, right, pressured, if you're really pushed against the wall with some big failure, well, you can work that, you know? That's a canoe ride to nirvana. So that's where we went. We took it, jumped in the canoe, and paddled to nirvana. So this big thing that he had, I mean, I was wandering aisle through aisle through aisle, and Beth somewhere shopping, and I'm wandering, and I got the phone right up to my ear. I mean, the conversation was 45 minutes or longer. You know, wandering, wandering, talking, wandering, playing around the drug aisle and the dry goods, and, you know, slipping through the automotive department, and, you know, people are looking at me, and I'm like, one of those kind. But so that's what it took, you know, 45 minutes or an hour, and we were looking at the texture of reality. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
And what does the texture of reality actually reveal? Nothing. It certainly doesn't reveal the story that he had coming into the conversation. It does not reveal that. You see, whatever's going on in your mind, even a big, you know, solid wall of hell, is ephemeral.
Because it's just mind-created stuff.
That's right.
It's just what the mind is doing.
It's ephemeral.
It's never ass on the chair, you know, hands next to you.
But even that is ephemeral. You are not going to find a reliable reality anywhere here. Not just mind. Your sensation is ephemeral. Your ass is ephemeral. Your hands on the chair is ephemeral. See, all there is the presence of experiencing. There's not a chair. There's just experiencing. So if the mind is telling you a big story about what a fuck-up you are, it's ephemeral. That's all this can do. There is no reality in terms of an existing, deterministic, reliable, malleable reality. There is no such thing. There's just experiencing. And if you feel experiencing as in what's present, it's a robustness of ephemera. That's what it is. Right now, this is a euphoric, an excruciating euphoric overload.
Why we blot it out? Because it's the overload.
Perhaps. It's worth investigating. You know, I don't know if anything's true for anyone, let alone everyone. But how could it be? But that's a fun string. Why might we blot out the presence of excruciating, ecstatic ephemera? What? Because it's hard to spell. I don't think so.
Motion sickness?
Could be. Hard to say. I mean, it certainly isn't for the reason that Wayne Lickerman says it happens.
What's he say?
He's just an idiot.
You love him.
I do love him. I do love him, but he's such an idiot. Blowhole. Anyway.
But doesn't that get a little bit to the, I mean, doesn't that deliver something? This false sense of authorship. Yeah, as in.
Let's not even go there. We can, but some other time.
All right.
I'm having too much fun. Why waste time on Wayne?
Why didn't make Wayne?
Yeah. Yeah. So here's reality, if there were one. We may as well call it reality. What the hell else are you going to call it? What is it actually doing? How is it showing up in you, irrefutably or otherwise? What's real? Real is imagined. What's so is so. That's not imagined. But it doesn't actually convey anything. You see? There's all this. But it doesn't convey anything that you can turn into a navigable universe. That's where we go wrong. We think that this profundity reflects or reveals a navigable universe in which I find myself as a creature.
Because we want to use it. We want to put it through text.
Yeah.
Fight it.
Yeah. I mean, hard to know.
Do you want the throw?
I don't want the throw at all.
It's big and
pretty. Sounds like a freelance.
You see, the moment you create a tautology, even a well-considered tautology, it's only appearing as an imaginary ephemera bubble. See, this does not actually convey a navigable universe, so you can't say why something happens or doesn't happen. And anyone that pretends to say why something happens or doesn't happen is mistaken. Thank God. That's awake. You are at the mercy of this. Or pull out the mercy part and you're this. Done. But you see, the moment you want utility, or a genesis, or a takeout box, or a hope, then you're back in the myth of a navigable universe that includes you as a creature. It's that good. It's that quick. It's that profound. Now, your present experience is present. Not possible to say what it is or isn't. Something's present. But you can't find space. You can't find time. You can't find self. The only thing that can be found is experiencing, experiencing, experiencing. Not to belabor someone else's clever use of those words, but see, here's experiencing. What else you got? Do you have something, really, really have something other than this is experiencing? And let's say you do. What evidence do you have for it? How reliable is it? Is it true? Is it really true? Who or what might you be without, right, that idea? Yeah. Yeah. So it can take it to that dimension where instead of negotiating with my experience as a human, right, as a psychiatric or biologic unit, with or without happiness, with or without sorrow, with or without satisfaction, once we just drop or leave behind, right, the myth of the story of you, then you have this, right? Here you are. Without the story of you. But you don't really know where you are, or how you got here, or what this actually is, or what's going to happen next, or what happened a moment ago. You see? Here you have what this is. No story associated with it. No before now, no after now. This is the reality. This is the fact. This.
So this is the ruination that you speak of, and this is dying before dying.
Well, the ruination refers, you know, to the notion that anyone has an idea about anything.
Funny ideas.
That could be handy to see. Yeah. Now, if you're a so-called person, you find yourself dependent upon ideas to frame some kind of utility or meaningfulness, what you call your life. That's how you get the meaning and the utility, is through ideas. Without ideas, where is the meaning or the purpose or the utility of this experiencing?
Where's the need for it?
Ditto, right. Where's the need?
No need.
No. No. And that can be thrilling and a little terrifying, because our habit to create need is the same as creating self. And then replying to the need or the explanation or the justification is just, right, little self behind the wheel of a motorhome.
A motor coffin.
The motor coffin is right. Yeah. Yeah. The visual field, the auditory field, the olfactory and tasting and sensorial field, the mind field, is just... What?
Oh.
What is this? Every glimmer, every shake, every sound, every contact is truly unutterable bliss. We fail to tune in or turn on the sensitivity, you could say, the subtlety that you're made of, to have a relationship with this beatitude, which is transhuman. Because your sensitivity and subtlety are not just on the ends or edges of your sense apparatus. See? You're way more subtle, magical, irrational than, right, the apparent measurabilities of the contact point of your so-called five senses and capacity for abstract association.
Doesn't it seem like this whole mechanism, this whole mind-body deal, is just poised at deconstruction? I mean, it's all about definition and focus. And that, I mean, it works against us, in a sense.
This miracle proliferates a profound hierarchical imaginarium that can be put on, right, like a sweater.
And we die and it goes off and then...
Maybe. Yeah, right.
So might as well do that.
Who's to say what anyone does with the suspicion that's arising in their first-hand experience? It's not like there's, you know, it's not like we're speaking at a conference to 400 people having this conversation. They're all talking to Adya Shanti, and I don't know what the fuck he's talking about. But they're getting something from it, right? You could say that's where their suspicion has brought them, right? Their reply for now to their existential adventure is on a 7-day silent retreat with Adya Shanti. Okay. I wish them luck. I mean, I wish everyone luck. You know, I want the best for everybody. You know, some people go see Wayne Lickerman and he starts hawking some bullshit about consciousness and knowledge and dualistically and non-dualistically, and this is not knowable, but it's knowable, but we can only use pointers because the reality, da 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 da, as if this shit is true. as if the references he's making to his kind audience actually mean something. And then they start laughing and having their various catharses, kind of in step, you know, with Wayne's hypnotic suggestions. They're like, okay, I wish you the best. I hope Wayne, you know, takes you all the way home, whatever that means.
I think we're afraid that self-obliteration is a big deal. It probably isn't. To open ourselves to the wondrousness of this, we know it would obliterate us. And we think that's you. It's not.
Yeah, who knows?
Yep.
I know, right.
It's huge to the extent that you hold on to yourself.
It's not conscious.
It's impossible to say what it is, because unless you're having the experience of, right, some kind of direct encounter with what you think you are in contrast to what you actually are, and then having, you know, a tussle with it, it's hard to say hypothetically what anything is. You go into an enlightenment dream and you start falling through a gearbox and, you know, you note some terror, right? Or you note bliss. You note, you know, ecstatic wonder that lasts a few minutes, you know, between 12:45 and 1 a.m. because you're feeling it and you go and pee, you go back to bed and then, you know, it's gone. And
yeah, and the rest of the night, it weren't good dreams. I dreamt I lost my temper, made a scene, and I felt shame.
You see? Yeah, it pretty much works that way. One minute enlightened, the next minute shamed. Rock, yeah, right, I know. So it's funny, we'd like to look at enlightenment or some kind of, you know, spiritual comeuppance as an event, as an accoutrement, as a reliability. Right? For the way I feel, the way I see, the way I act, that I could perhaps be kind to people someday, that's not happening. Right?
So harboring some hope.
Yeah. But that's not, but see, all of that is more ephemera, isn't it? If anything is true, this is dreaming miraculously right now. And your experience is so bizarre that you can't actually report on it with any accuracy at all, even though you might like to. You can't. The only thing you can report on are hypothetical snippets, which is a nice way of saying you're lying through your teeth. When you tell a story about yourself or a dream or an enlightenment experience or going back to shame or whatever it is, all that's appearing is a presently expressed hypothetical snippet in the midst of the otherwise inconquerable and impersonal beatitude, which completely sweeps you away from moment to moment. Is this an event? No. So you wake up just to see what is presently occurring on reality's terms, not on your imaginary terms. So this is no longer an event. And nothing needs to happen to you in terms of some kind of fanciful accoutrement referred to as enlightenment. This is not an event. Nothing needs to happen to you. You can create a sense of self that has been below average, that wants to become above average. Yeah, or hopefully average. Yes. You see, but it's just ephemera. This doesn't actually convey, cannot actually convey a navigable reality. That's very strange. I mean, you can go home and fix your bathroom, maybe. Knowing it's you.
It's a big maybe.
I know, it's a big maybe. But it's stranger than that. I mean, you can apparently return to the artifacts of your life and relations, your wardrobe, your house, right? And your safety deposit box if you've got anything in it. You can do that, apparently. But it's dreamed. And you see that not by regurgitating your past, because your past feels somehow real to you. And you do that not by trying to enter your future, which is more vague than your past. Right? You can only do it here, now. You can only see what reality is made of now. Experiencing is occurring. It has no duration, though it doesn't stop. It has no durability, though you can injure yourself if you run into a wall. And you can't really feel this through what we refer to as mind.
And yet that seems to be the only way we can feel this.
That's what we're trying to unlock. Right? Kashmiri yoga, Dzogchen yoga, Hatha yoga practiced well, as intended, are all about unlocking. Unlocking the reliance that one places on thought, on ephemera, on hypothetical abstraction to convey reality. Yeah. Unlock from it. You're feeling this before you're thinking about it. Thought appears in your feelingness. Thought's not running the show. Thought is not an arbiter or an authority.
Thoughts seem to tend to take the show, steal it.
It's possible one can give, consciously or otherwise, sufficient loyalty to thought to believe what it's saying, and therefore occupy an imaginary reality that thought is attempting to convey. Yeah, this can do that. So, you're out on the fields there, right, and you've mowed the hay and raked the hay and baled the hay, and each time you might have to pull the machine off the PTO drive and unhook it from the ball jack on the tractor, right? Well, you have to do the same thing with yourself. You have to unhook yourself from yourself.
Farming analogies. Wow.
Yeah, I rode on a farmal H and a farmal M and did some baling, and you bet.
They're right over my head.
Yeah, I know.
It's good to drive a tractor. Now, it's not that difficult, really, to unhinge from yourself. It's not. It is, as a matter of fact, it's so strangely easy. It's like Dorothy going, you mean I could go to Kansas anytime? Yes. why on earth did I meet these crazy people and, you know, fuss with the monkeys and the witch and the wizard and the golden road and the opium in the fields? That I would still do. But what? Yeah, you know. And the good witch said, well, you had to find out for yourself. That's this. You can unhinge from this. Right now. With oddly no effort. In fact, that's the only way. You can't unhinge from the imagination of the tunnel vision of your life through effort. Cushion won't help. Mantra won't help.
Hatha yoga won't help.
Hatha yoga won't help.
Practice well or not.
Right. Yeah, they won't really help, but that doesn't mean don't do them. They won't help. They're like the red shoes. See? All of that stuff that you do, Course in Miracles, Byron Katie, Wayne Lickerman, Peter Brown, everything that you do, do it. I mean, really, do it. But it won't help. Because they're your shoes. They're nobody else's shoes. You got the ruby slippers.
Correlation isn't causation.
So you can unhinge from the universe in which you think you live.
How is it that seemingly so few do?
Well, I think your own life is as good an answer as any. It's weird. It's crazy. It does itself. That's why. It's just bizarre.
The ramifications of being a biological entity.
If there were any, and there are none, so it's hard to say that it's the ramification of anything. This dreams. It really, really, really dreams. Not like a little bit, but like big. Yeah. I mean, why does the quark that makes up your structure agree on quark, molecular, atomic, photonic, cellular, molecular, tissue, specificity, and differentiation? So that you could get out of bed, read a little Nietzsche, and get a cup of coffee. What the hell? What the hell? So when you look into the minutiae of what appears as a upright, stand-up, biological good fella, you're made out of pure chaos, down to the bone, down to the marrow of the bone, down to the blood, down to the molecule in the blood cell, down to the iron in the red blood cell that's there to transfer the oxygen from the ambient atmosphere into the most minute capillaries somewhere in your rear end. And yet we think, oh, well, I am going to make a decision. Oh, really? I hope it's the right one. You're just a ball of quarks with an attitude, with a big attitude, claiming, 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 clinging, clinging, claiming, claiming, clinging, clinging, claiming, claiming, claiming. When's my appointment with my therapist?
I think you have to cling off. You should just, like, at a frantic pace just to keep up with it.
It's doing it, and it's better than you. Yeah. This is fast. This is really fast. I mean, it's so fast that it's only one thing, so it doesn't have far to travel. To dream you. That's how fast it is.
It almost seems like deliberate sabotage.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, if you're racked with the samsara consequences of being a total loser, then it feels that way. It's a big sabotage event. Yeah. And on the journey, right, from being the biggest possible loser or the smallest possible loser, depending on how you, you know, want to uphold yourself, right? The first thing, when you look at the hierarchy of needs, I mean, the first things that you attend to are more survival-oriented, right? Water, food, elimination, right? Warmth, procreation, right? So breathing the invisible gas turns out to be really important. But you never paid any attention. Whoa. God, I'm so glad there's oxygen in this room. Right? Remember what's-her-name in one of those space movies? You know, when the oxygen pours out of the cockpit, you know. All of them. Every beautiful woman that's been in a space movie had to deal with, you know, an oxygen deprivation moment. Yeah, they all did. Right? Yeah, Sandra Bullock pressing the buttons, closing the hatch, throwing George Clooney out. The breasts heave. Yeah, you're good. Cleavage. Oh, she's having an oxygen deprivation movie moment. We put that in each movie. Huh, nice rack. Sure hope the oxygen comes.
I almost did a spit take on that one.
You know, so let's say you're breathing. Okay, that's cool. Nice. I mean, why do you think the Buddhists used jhanic practice as, right, their vehicle for liberation? Well, they go to the rudimentary rhythm. You can't do much about your cranial rhythm unless you're a very subtle yogi. Most people aren't even aware that there is a cranial rhythm. Most physicians aren't even aware that there's a cranial rhythm. It doesn't even exist for them. So just imagine how subtle you have to become to start moving, managing consciously, working with your cranial rhythm, right? Some yogas do that, but you're not going to find them written up on Amazon. But you can find the yogas like Buddhist jhanic practice that works with the subtlety, the refinement of the breath. Because all you got, right? There's all these rhythms. And what's the most kind of like fundamental rhythm you got? Breathing in, breathing out. Who gives a shit what your mind's thinking, right? Breathing in, breathing out.
It seems like the downside of anything like this, it seems balancing, like, okay, you're going to go to jhanic practice, like,
yeah.
Rest, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll really, like, jazz up my hatha yoga practice. I've been doing it for
yep.
20 years now. Like,
yeah, jazz it up.
The biggest issue with all that
yeah.
is that it seems to just... Like, you always
have
blinders on, and that's it.
Yes. Fetishizing reality happens faster than you can say boo. Or oob.
Like
if you want to go backwards. Or boo.
I say that's the biggest problem with that stuff.
It's not a problem.
It just gives you an identity, or you think that's the right.
No, it's not a problem. It's only a problem if you take residence as a creature. If you don't take residence as a creature, it's not a problem. It's beauty itself.
It's the person resident as a creature that thinks she wants to just jump on there and ride so hard.
Yes, 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 yes. That's what we're unhinging. You see? You're not a creature. You're not.
That you endeavor into anything seems to give you more residence as a creature. Sitting here in Sunday lunches with you give me residence as a creature because... something to do
yeah.
Hold on
yes.
To give me a little hope.
Yes. If you're okay. filling your, if you're filling your social calendar with relevant spiritual things to do, yes, then you're a creature and you've got a calendar, and you're going to select the most entertaining or bang for the buck spiritual things to do because that's just how you roll. Fine, no problem. Yeah.
It's not a problem.
No.
It does seem to sort of work against it.
No one's free of it.
Can you get rid of this, like, do on my shoe call it this person?
No need. Yeah, no need. You're here. That's it. This here-ness is enough. And I'm not saying you're here at Andre's having breakfast. You're here. That's it. being here is strange. Not knowing what this is permits your here-ness to transmute where you sit, right where you are. Oh, oh my goodness. I mean, the experiencing is, it's awesome. When you don't want anything from this, the gift of it pours in. The moment you want something from it, you can only want something from it from the vantage point of being a creature. Yes? So, and as long as you're a creature, well, then you're idiotically insatiable. But not, no need to insult anyone. Just because you're idiotically insatiable doesn't mean you should take umbrage. Is it really that difficult to disbelieve for fun every idea that's appearing in your experience? It's not that difficult to do. Because you're feeling this first. Not that there's a hierarchy or a temporality or a, you know, a sine wave. Your feeling is primary. Thought, association, dreaming oneself as a creature, seeking utility, being vulnerable or apprehensive are packets, right? Photon packets appearing in your feeling. That's key. Before this is telling a story, as in you telling a story to yourself, presence is irrefutable. It's felt. Want to reach? This way. Right, so the Hatha Yogas and the Pranayamas and all of these really beautiful, beautiful human balletic movements, all of them without fail are designed to bring to your attention that you are primarily, your primacy feels this. And it's possible to take up residence, in a curious way of speaking, in your primacy. And not really give a shit about what reality is going to do with you or not. So you have no genuine possessions or appointments. You do not have to interfere or steer or seduce or cajole reality to give you what it is you think you want or need or deserve. You can truly fuck off.
That's so
Yeah. Well, it's magnificent. But it's not so easy. Simple, but not easy. At hand, but impossibly hidden. It's all that there is. It's so in your face. But look how easy it is to refuse. Every gesture, every sensation, every photon striking your retina, every sound. It's total. And that's the sensitivity that you're actually made of. Once, let's say, it's pointed out to you. I mean, growing up, you know, as a consequence of the minds of muggles, you're turned into a creature. So at some point, if you're lucky, you start hanging out with wizards that are just done with the creature myth. It's not popular. Plenty of seats. Plenty of seats. Yeah. Yeah. It's like if you're not a creature, and this is transcendent, please, keep your money. I don't want it. And you don't have to hang out with someone to get what you already are, what this already is. I mean, you can hang out with wizards because it's more fun than hanging out with muggles. Because the conversation and the sensation and the titillation and the discovery, the yoga, is just more pleasing to you. When it is. When it becomes more pleasing, then it's more pleasing. And so you please yourself by exposing yourself to situations where you can be reminded of your transcendent nature rather than abused by someone that treats you like a creature. Isn't it weird that as the creature starts to dissipate, the motives that we used to have for being enlightened have to change? You see, you don't know what to do anymore. Because it used to be that enlightenment was a remedy for having a sucky experience as a creature. Well, now there's no Velcro anymore, because you're not a creature. So what the hell does your best idea of enlightenment have to do with you anyway? Whoa. We thought, oh, enlightenment's the golden ring. No, it's not. And the people that sell it that way, they should all replace the people that are in jail for smoking marijuana. Everyone that smokes marijuana should come out of jail, and everyone that sells enlightenment should go into jail. They can sell it to the other inmates. And hopefully get a nice reach around.
That's their prison.
I'd love to see Jeff Foster typing from a prison cell. Jeff, it's time for your 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
What good is your personality besides being beautiful and crazed? Otherwise, you know, no biggie. When you're no longer under the influence of what you're imagining, you're here. Get used to it. And that's well within your grasp, well within your fortitude, well within your affection. You're here. Why fuck it up by trying to get enlightened? Why create a mess of all of this beauty trying to get enlightened? As a remedy for what you're not. That's all it is. It's non-stop. It doesn't stop. You just keep falling through clouds. This doesn't create a navigable reality that you can actually find yourself in. It just dreams. You could do the experiment with a piece of bread. I mean, here you are, and this looks like, right, the agreeable reality, right? But then you can, like, do this and go, oh, my God! Oh, whoa! Or, oh, my God! Oh. Where was that experience? Was it a lady in waiting? Had it been set up by God, just hoping that you might pounce on it? No, it's just dreaming. You see, it just dreams and seats you. It dreams on spot. It wasn't waiting for you to run into a tree. The entirety of all that appears is more or less at your disposal, but not premeditated. It's streaming. And try to recall what happened to you 3 seconds ago. Not happening. Can't happen. You cannot actually recall what's happening to you now. It's dreaming. It's ephemera. You see? It imagines. You can't actually say what's happening to you right now. Right now. As right now is happening, you can't say what it is. How valuable is your memory of it? But we rely on memory as something that actually conveys the truth. That tells us the truth about what happened. How convenient. It's like church lady. We can't say or know with any accuracy or certainty what's happening as in right now. Because it's too bizarre. It's because it's dreamy, because it's ephemeral, because it's not real, because it doesn't convey a navigable, findable universe. That's why we can't do it. Not because you're an idiot, not because you're not well-read, not because you're not trying. Because you can't. Why can't you? Because this isn't really happening. It's just dreaming. It's just ephemera. It's complete, robust, profound, in all and every respects. That's why you can't say what's happening right now. Because it's too strange. That's why. That might be a useful discovery. Because then you could say, well, how could I possibly convince myself of anything that happened prior to this moment if it has become quite clear to me I don't know what's happening right now? Then that whole loyalty that one places on thought could hopefully fall apart. But it doesn't mean you can't sweat the plumbing together and run some cold water to the tap. Or have a bite of toast. Or paint a Picasso, if you're Picasso. Otherwise, you'd be a forger.
Like that one guy who forged all those paintings.
You're a forger anyway. Look at your mind, look at your thoughts, look at your feelings and sensations and the things that you tell yourself. You might notice that it's all forgery. You are counterfeit. It's all counterfeit. But we get very excited about it because we think that this is a durable, deliverable, navigable reality in which we find ourselves. But it's not. So you might lighten up from forgery, playing with a loaded deck, insisting that you're not counterfeit when you are. Awake has no utility for humans. It just doesn't. And the people that would like you to believe that so you'll buy their book and their CD and come to their workshop are racketeers. Just like you accuse people of shit, it doesn't mean it's true. I've seen most of those racketeers. Made fun of some of them, you know.
Some of them are your friends?
Some of them are my friends. Some years ago, Peter was put together a concert with some musician friends of his when other friends were running the Hillside Club in Berkeley, which is a very old, one of the few remaining social clubs. Kind of a bizarre not-for-profit thing. Very few exist anymore. They were really big at the turn of the whatever, you know, for the arts and for this and that. Social clubs would get created. They're all Poolville money. They would buy a big building, right? They would get together. But it wasn't a 501c3 or a 50, you know. It was just a social club. So they could pool all their funds and get things done without having to pay taxes on their activities. Very few remaining. The Hillside Club in Berkeley happens to be one of the few still remaining. So friends were the managers of that facility. And it has a big, beautiful hall where you can have a wedding or a rock and roll concert. So Peter got together with some friends, a really nice bass player and a great drummer, and put on a space music show. and it's recorded. You can listen to it. It's wild shit. Really, it's like, you know, it's like just fun. It's just ambient weirdness. So I got stoned with the drummer because I could, and took a walk around, you know, the block, and had fun at the show. Anyway, that wasn't the point. The point was, I said to Peter before they started performing, I said, "Did you invite your friends?" And he looks at me in one of those, you know, enlightened ways that someone can look at you, and I have no friends. You know, it was one of those lop your head off moments with the master, you know. Okay, I'm sorry I asked. You know, you're just like, it's pretty funny. And then some years later, or I don't know, in the last 6 months or something, I remember going out to, you know, the West Coast and showing up at one of those lunches at an Indian restaurant. And I come in and Peter's talking to this wonderful fellow named Saran. Not as in rap, but...
Not as in Sirhan.
Not in Sir, yeah. Sirhan. And Peter's talking to him, and they're animated, and I walk in, and he says, "Oh, let me introduce you to my friend, Jeff." And I'm like, "What is it with you?" You know? I mean, do you have friends, or don't you have friends? You know, what did I do to actually earn, right, the privilege and delight of being introduced as your friend? You can't trust anybody.
I guess you have to invite yourself to his home.
Yeah, yeah, you have. Yeah, you have to encroach on people for them to finally figure out that you're their friend. Too strange.
Well, he was just being colloquial. It's just, you know.
Yeah. It's okay to be moody.
Thank God.
You know? Does this mood stay the same? Not for an instant. The Divine Mother who runs everything is out of her mind. She's nuts. She is so stoned and wild. She is not going to obey you. She's not going to listen to you. She's not going to comfort you. No chance.
Good mommy, bad mommy.
Not happening. She's just off the charts. Well, you have to, you know, you have to, if you're into it, you have to kind of align yourself with her way of thinking, not your way of thinking. You have to chill out so profoundly, effortlessly, that you can listen to what she has to say. Because any agenda that you've got is not what this is. We can't wake up as humans, because how we feel or express as human is myth. It's not true. But the waking up can dispel the myth of human. You can listen to how the Divine Mother rolls, not how you roll. But that's going to crush you. That's going to wring everything out of you. Because that's chaos. Unadulterated, irreverent, excruciatingly ecstatic chaos from moment to moment that takes no prisoners. That's what this is.
It's a big lie that we can control what we say.
Yeah.
In our box, and we're saying that's a big lie.
She does love to play, and she's, you know, she's 24/7, right? Yeah, she loves to play. She's 24/7. which suggests that you can have a profound, ecstatic relationship with her on tap. If someone's got a better way to live, okay. I don't think there is one. Woo!